We're very happy to have Brother David and Sister Ruth all the way up from southern country come up all the way north. We're looking forward to the discourse, and Brother David has prepared a message for us today entitled Trouble and Blessing. Trouble and Blessing. Brother David, thank you.
Dear brethren, it's a pleasure to be with you. I bring with us the love and greetings of the San Diego class who expressly voted to have that done. And it's just wonderful to be back in your midst after a couple of years. You know, I remember Ruth and I were talking in the car some time ago about some other convention. We said, you know, we didn't remember hearing about a Kalispell convention in 2010. No. And right after that, I got a letter from Sister Faith, and I'm so pleased that to know that they were continuing. I didn't know that it was biennial, but now it's been formally declared. In the Christian life, we have first trouble and then a great blessing. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 13 says, "You are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when he is revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy, because we will be in the resurrection." Psalms 119:71. "It is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I might learn thy statutes." Now, with Jesus, that maybe was a little different, because Jesus never went astray. He never was afflicted for anything he did wrong. As, for instance, the psalmist says, "Before I was afflicted, I went astray." So we have to be corrected. But that was Jesus. But of Jesus even it was said, "Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things that he suffered." And I think that learning doesn't mean imply a disobedience, but rather he learned an intensity and a crystallization of his character to appreciate righteousness. And when you suffer for righteousness, you appreciate it more deeply even than otherwise. Hebrews 12, verse 5, however, is to us, "Despise not the chastening of the Lord." Now that's something that Paul quoted from the Old Testament. I think that's in Proverbs, the third chapter. And in Romans 8, verse 18, "The sufferings of the present are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us." Now nothing new here. We all know that. And as Peter said, "Endure suffering now. No trial is pleasant for the time being, but afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. And far beyond that, it's going to yield the blessed state of glory for those that are properly exercised by the sufferings now." Now, the Lord would love to give us honor and glory and dignity and a place of great esteem if we can bear it. But we can't bear it unless first we suffer the afflictions and the humbling and the patience necessary beside the veil. Even Jesus said to his disciples in Luke chapter 24, verse 26, when they were surprised about his death, he says, as he joined them on the way to Emmaus, two of the disciples, and he was not yet disclosed who he was to them, he says, "Ought not Christ to have suffered these things and then to enter into his glory?" And we realize that's the case with every one of us who has given our life to the Heavenly Father as well. Now that applies not only to us, but that same principle actually also applies to the world. They're going to go through a period of suffering and distress first before the blessings of the kingdom. Now the suffering and distress consumes a period of 6,000 years in which they're learning the lessons of experience. Now I remember when 9/11 exploded upon the scene, and I remember Billy Graham said at that time publicly, and I just heard it again recently, we don't really know why God permits these things. And it was brought home to me forcibly by a very humble and dear sister in San Diego. She was at her midweek meeting at the time. Her name is Sister Mary Ellen Wagner. That's Mary Ellen Moore. And she said she always considered herself very humble and like the least of the least. And she said, "I heard him say that," and I said to myself, Well, I know why God commits evil. Even I know that." And I think all of us appreciate knowing that deep truth, that God is allowing evil in order to show mankind the natural consequences of a wayward course. So they, when the good time comes, then they can appreciate by contrast the blessings that they will receive in the future. But if you don't know about an opportunity for life in the kingdom, then the whole thing is closed to you. Well, in Daniel the 12th chapter, we have something that tells us about trouble and then blessing. This is Daniel 12, verses 1 and 2, a very well-known text to all of you. At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And then verse 2, many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. So there's going to be a resurrection of the dead, and in fact all the dead, after a period of trouble that introduces the kingdom. Now, it's my understanding that we are already in that time of trouble. Now, of course, the climax has not yet come to us, but I think that time of trouble is constituted of various waves of difficulty and punctuated with three wars of intensity. World War I, World War II, and then the Armageddon conflict that, in my understanding, will break out as a war in the Middle East and then spread to difficulties back in the home countries. Now, in chapter 12, verse 1, when it says, Michael shall stand up, that seems like such an innocuous term, we might pass right by that. It just means he's going to take power. But I think it may have a more precise meaning than that. If you see how this expression, stand up, is used in the 11th chapter of Daniel, it's all part of one prophecy, you know. It's actually used six times, at least, in Daniel, the 11th chapter, every time, talking about a king coming to the throne. Now look, for example, in Daniel 11, verse 2. Now I will show you the truth. There shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth, and so on and so on. To stand up means to come to the throne. Now in verse 3, a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion. That's Alexander the Great, by just common acclamation. I think just about everybody sees that point. Verse 4, when he shall stand up, come to the throne, be king. Now look at verse 7. Out of a branch of her root shall one stand up. That is, her brother is going to become king. That's what it means. And it's very interesting to go through all these details here, but we're not going to do that today. Just this point, that stand up means to come to the throne. Verse 20. Then shall stand up in the estate of the fallen ruler a raiser of taxes. He will come to the throne. Verse 21, in his estate shall stand up a vile person. So in chapter 12, verse 1 says, then Michael's going to stand up. That means that Christ is going to take authoritative action as a regent, authoritative kingly command, and begin his reign. I think first of conquering the institutions that be, leading later to his reign of righteousness and blessing and his priestly glory. Now, this helps, by the way, to understand who Michael is. Now, I think most of the brethren know that Michael is our Lord Jesus. It's a name for the angelic being that he was. His title was Logos, his name was Michael. However, it's not as clearly stated in Scripture as you might like to have it when you're challenged by some that don't agree with that point. Now, even among the brethren, there is sometimes a discussion on this question. But certainly, outside the pale of the Brotherhood of Present Truth, there is a big question about that, because Michael was an angel. Everybody would agree an angel is a creation of God. And if Jesus is Michael, that means Jesus is a created being. Now, that's very clear to us, but not at all clear to most of Christendom out there. So when you understand that Michael here is taking regal authority in beginning to reign and exercise kingly authority, maybe that will help them to see, well, which of the angels is ever going to become king? But one of them, well, that's Michael. That's our prince. That's Michael, Jesus himself. Now, just to add a sidelight onto this, in Hebrews 3:3 about Michael. Hebrews 3:3 is Paul just talking about Jesus as compared to Moses. For this man was counted worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he that builded the house has more honor than the house. Now, it took me a long time to really grasp what Paul's saying there. He's saying Jesus is the one that constructed the old house of servants. Well, how did Jesus do that? Well, in his pre-human glory, he was the one that was established over Israel. That's why Daniel says, Michael, your prince, talking to the Hebrews. He is the prince of the Hebrew nation, as it were, the one that God used to appoint over them, to prepare them, establish them, and so forth. He is the angel of God's presence that I think is referred to back to Moses. Now, the Hebrews knew this. You look at McClintock and Strong's under Michael, and they will say the Jewish people and the rabbinical teachings consider Michael to be the patron angel appointed as the caretaker of Israel. I think that's what Paul had in his mind when he said he built the house of sons of servants, and therefore he's greater than that house of servants. And his point was that Jesus, as Michael, was the patron supervisor and builder of Israel, and the Jewish mind would get that point. You know, Christians would miss that point, perhaps, but McClintock and Strong picks that up. Now, in Daniel 12, verse 2, there is a little problem here with our concept of a universal resurrection. It says, many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. Well, aren't they all? Well, yes. But you know, when you go to Romans, the 5th chapter, by one man's disobedience, many were made sinners. He doesn't exclude anybody. He just affirms that everybody turns out to be quite a number of people. That's many. So in Daniel, it doesn't really mean some will miss this privilege. It merely affirming that the many of the human race will rise again. And if there's any question on it at all, there's positive assurance in John 5, 20 and 29. The hour is coming in which all that are in their grave shall hear the voice of the Son of Man, and they will come forth. No question that it's comprehensive. Now, the time of trouble that is introduced here in Daniel, the 12th chapter, I think we have seen since 1914. Now, sometimes we recognize there's going to be a crescendo of this in the future. That's true. But I want to focus on this time of trouble today. We're going to talk about the trouble that the world has seen, where it's leading to, and the steps by which it is unfolding, leading to the time of great, great blessing. Blessing so wonderful that the world does not grasp, really, the wonder that is in the path that the storm is going to leave in its residue. Now, Paul does say in Romans, the 8th chapter, I like the Phillips translation referred to earlier by somebody else, the whole world is standing on tiptoe, waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God, because then the whole creation will be emancipated from the thraldom of sin. And they're expecting something. They don't know what. They're hoping for something. But we know what they're going to get, and we know how wonderful it will be. There's still kind of a veiled hope and wish that it'll be greater than their poets and philosophers have ever dreamed it could be. But first the trouble. Now, I think that the Bible students have been so anxious for the kingdom, they've been kind of thinking in terms of quickly. You know, even Peter said before Jesus rose on the Mount of Olives, will you at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel? And Jesus' answer is very telling. He didn't say, oh, Peter, you got the wrong idea. Israel has lost their chance. He said, basically, paraphrased, not yet, later. And then he was taken up in glory. And then Peter, of course, would probably piece this together in his mind. Okay, the angel said he's coming back again. So when he comes back, that'll be the time for establishing again the kingdom to Israel. Well, now the Lord has come back. Has Israel been restored? Well, not completely. But their nationhood is back. There are people again since 1878 that have been coming back to the land. 1948 reestablishes a nation. We're going to look at that date, 1948, a little bit later in our lesson, if we have time to get to it. And that is a portent of what's coming. When you see the fig tree, and then all the trees multiplied, you know the kingdom of God is near at hand. And that is telling us we're on the verge. But way back before 1914, before the time of trouble really broke upon the world, the brethren were thinking that maybe when the time of trouble came, it would be fairly quick, and then the church would be complete. And even when World War I started, and the brethren were all still here, Brother Russell still said in 1916, volume 3 forward, we still expect that within a year or two or maybe three, all of the saints will be beyond the veil, the door will be closed, and the kingdom will be established. What was the problem? The problem was not a mistake on the time of trouble when it would come, but rather a mistake in understanding the extent and the scope and the breadth of the time of trouble to prepare the hearts of men. It wouldn't be a quick experience of a year or two or three or four. It would be a long period. Now, we can say that with positiveness now. You know, so often people say, I don't want to be dogmatic about this point. Well, here we can be dogmatic because we're not looking forward, we're looking back. And we've seen over 100 years of trouble descending upon the world. And what we're going to look at today are scriptures and prophecy that now in hindsight we can see tell us the time of trouble would be a long time before finally it would climax with the blessing of all the families of the earth. Now, we're going to go back for this in time to something that you well know. It's in the experience of Elijah. We've talked about this from time to time, so it won't be brand new. Even if we'd never talked about it, it wouldn't be new. You'd still know about it. It's in Volume 2 and Volume 3. And it starts way back in 1 Kings, the 17th and 18th chapters, with the experience of Elijah. And Elijah predicted to King Ahab, there will not be dew nor rain these years except by my word, as a prophet of God. Now, way back in Deuteronomy, God had predicted, if you are disobedient to the law, I will cause the heavens to withhold its rain and its dew and all the blessings you receive that. And Elijah just knew this, for somehow, he had a prophetic indication. This was the right time for that to be applied. And so he pronounced it with vigor. And sure enough, for 3.5 years, there was no rain. And that's a picture for us that during the gospel age, when wicked Queen Jezebel, a picture of the Catholic hierarchy, and Ahab, the government's allied to her, would be in power persecuting the Lord's people, there would be a lack of truth and understanding, be a drought of the Word of God that would extend for a long time. So that we usually begin with the year 539. And that drought of truth went on for 1,260 years. Now, we're going to put a few dates on the board here. 539 AD, when that drought of truth started. And that's when papacy came into political authority. How'd that happen? Well, there was a series of wars in Italy. And Justinian, the Roman emperor that really ruled from Constantinople, then sent an army over to Italy to free Italy of the Gothic power. And when Italy was finally near free, Rome was free, he put the Pope in charge of Rome to kind of be an ally to control it for him while his general went out to conquer the Goths elsewhere. And finally, the Gothic stronghold of Ravenna fell, and that was temporarily a check to that problem. That was in 539. That's the date, 539. Now, Volume 3, we come down 1,260 years later. We get to the year 1799, when papacy was headless because the Pope died as a prisoner in France of, by this time, Napoleon. And papacy was briefly headless. And it recovered a little later. But and even papal historians mark 1799 as a new epoch in the history of papacy, the history of the popes. And they break a chapter right there, 1799, because of the events then. And after that, that would be 1,260 years involved here, times and a half, prophetic years. And then after that, Daniel goes on to say, beyond the 1260, there'll also be a 1,290 years, extending 30 years beyond that. That takes you to the year 1829. And then there's another prophecy that intervenes there. I'll get to that in a moment. But then finally, you get to the 1335 years, and that ends in 1874. Scraping here. And then there's one prophecy that intervenes in Daniel the 8th chapter. And that's the 2300 year prophecy. And brethren, often take that to 1846. I think that it falls just a little differently. It's not much of a difference here, but I'm going to put down here a year of 1843. I'm not going to go into the details of that, but it's about the crescendo of the Miller movement. Let's just leave it at that for now. So this is a series of prophetic episodes, 1260 days, 1290 days, 2300 days. It starts way, way back even before. And finally, the 1335 days ending in 1874. And that's as far as the prophecy of Daniel chapter 12 goes. The very last two verses of Daniel 12 take you up to that date point. And that's where it leaves you. And then, as we know, the experiences of prophecy, there was to be kind of another date in the future, 40 years beyond that, and that date is 1914. And so the brethren all look to that as the time when the crescendo of judgment will come and the blessings will come. But now we know it's been a longer time than that. Now here's where we pick up the thread of thought in 1 Kings chapter 19. This is after the rain has fallen. This is after all these periods of time are passed, you know, prophetically. And now we get to the time in Revelation, 1 Kings 19, that Ahab is under threat again and he has to flee for his life again. And while he's fleeing, he rests under a juniper tree. He's quite weary at this time. And he tells the Lord, I'm not better than my forebears. Just let my life be taken. Now, I remember dear brother Robert Seclemian, who many of you will still remember. Surely you will, because he was right in your neck of the woods. And I remember a talk he gave on this. He was a storyteller, you know, a lovely storyteller. And he said, Elijah was very weary, very depressed. And when we're weary and depressed, we will say things that give rise to things we don't really truly mean. He says, if Elijah really meant he was ready to die, all he had to do is wait for Jezebel's men to catch up to him, and they would be happy to oblige. But he didn't really mean it thoroughly. So the Lord knew how to take care of Elijah, though. He said, you need some help. Well, first of all, this is during this period of time, excuse me. And so he rested, and he was fed. He was fed the first time by an angel appearing to him and providing some water and some nourishment. And so it said Elijah ate, and I think that represents the first feeding of the brethren after the 1260 years had ended. That was with the Adventist movement. Now, we have a date of 1829 in the prophecy, and you know in volume 3, Brother Russell says, that's about the time the Miller movement started in the United States. Yes, it's about the time, but not quite. Miller really picked up in 1832. I think it was his first preaching service, about 1832. And it was, if you want to get to 1829, you've got to go back somewhere else. I think you have to go over the pond back to England to find the prophetic affairs that were going on then. And in 1829, there was a prophetic conference that had been held quarterly for some years at the estate of a Henry Drummond. He had various clerics come in that were prophetically minded, and they discussed and reviewed the prophecies. And in 1829, they published a compendium of their findings. Very engaging findings that they came up with. They said that Christian nations are not just going to fade away, they're going to be consumed by a series of judgments by the Lord, preparatory to the final end that the Lord has. And during this time, his natural people, Israel, will be coming back to their ancient homeland. And there's going to be a greater hope for the world, even for, as they put it, the unwitting creation. That is, the creation is unaware of the blessings coming. Well, that's a pretty good foundation. The wise were beginning to understand. And that's what it says at the end of the 1260 days. The wise would begin to understand. So I think it starts there, and then it picks up during the Miller movement here in America. 1843, that's the date that William Miller anticipated the Lord would return. Now, he wasn't right, but he wasn't entirely wrong. I think he had the prophecy correct. He just misunderstood what that prophecy was pointing to. It was the cleansing of the sanctuary. And I think at the crescendo of the Miller movement, that's when many of the thoughts that we now embrace as parts of present truth had come into focus. They just weren't all put together quite as a package yet. That would await a little later for the Lord's return and the sumptuous feast of present truth that would come with the Lord's return. Now, I just want to put a little marker here that from 1799 to 1843 be a period of, 44 years. And then you have to wait another 31 years before you finally find the full fruition of the blessings that were kind of building on the Miller movement, but not really formed thoroughly until after the Lord's return. Now, it turns out that Elijah was fed here, and then it says he laid down again to sleep. And now you remember in Matthew 25, verse 6, it says, all the virgins went out to meet their Lord, just like the Miller movement did, but while he tarried, they all slumbered and slept.
And I think that's like Elijah going to sleep again after that first feeding. And so you went back to sleep at the crescendo of the pillar movement, disappointment. And then at midnight, the cry, "Behold the bridegroom." And I think that synchronizes with 1874 and the return of Christ. And that's where they all rose again. And my point here is this. Every one of these experiences of Elijah seems to map one of the time prophecies in the book of Daniel. That connection, I think, tells us we're on the right track. You know, if you have one line of evidence and interpretation that looks pretty good to you, you say, that looks pretty good. You know, I wish there was a cross-check on this. Now we got another line of evidence, you know, in the prophecies of Daniel, and they mesh exactly. And you say, I think maybe we're on the right track here. Well, now, what happened next to Elijah? It says he was fed a second time. That's the feeding of present truth. And it says he went in the strength of that food for 40 days until Mount Horeb. 40 days. Is that possible? That could be a day for a year. That would be 40 years to 1914. And at Mount Horeb, he saw the wind, the earthquake, and the fire unleash. And I think that wind, earthquake, and fire is a picture of the troubles that would follow 1914. And there are three stages of trouble. Now, you know, when the brethren saw World War I, they thought, this might be it. Maybe it'd take a little longer, we thought, to get through it, but surely the kingdom will come. But no, it all stabilized in 1918, kept on going, Europe rebuilt, and it built up to a second World War. I don't think there was a way ahead of time to understand that. We look back retrospectively and we can see it. So I think the winds of war really were unleashed from 1914 and forward. And how long did it take before the war phase was ended? Well, Second World War ended in 1945, right? I mean, I wasn't around, but that's what I understand from history. So you go to 1945. And I think that's when the war phase ended. Now, the next phase of trouble, there was to be the winds of war, and then the earthquake. Now, we mentioned a text earlier, Luke 21, about verse 20, when you see the fig tree and all the trees, then you know the kingdom is nigh. Fig tree was in 1948. All the trees, maybe the breakup of all of the colonial empires that proliferated the number of nations. And in 1947, that was India. In the 1960s, many of the African countries, the 1970s was it, Indochina broke up, and you've seen all these countries, and I think maybe in retrospect now, the last of those to break up was the Soviet Union. And I think that we can put that in 1989. Now, technically, the Soviet Union didn't technically legally come to an end until 1981. But if you look at Wikipedia, the source you know that we use so much these days, you actually find a Wikipedia entry called, quote, "Revolutions of 1989. That was the year when Poland became independent. Hungary, East Germany, Bulgaria, the Czechoslovakia, they later split, Romania." And this was a very tumultuous year. This is when the Berlin Wall came down. This is when things really changed. That's the year I remember. It sticks in my mind. Because I remember thinking we're at the crescendo of another prophetic point. How do we integrate all this? And I think there is a way. I think that was, well, you know, I'm just going to hold that in abeyance for just now. Get ahead of myself here. So, we have these prophetic markers, but that's not the end yet. We still got one more problem to undergo, and that's the fire, the wind, the earthquake, and the fire. And so we have another period of years, some decades to go, before finally that fire phase ends. And you remember what happened after the wind, the earthquake, and fire all subsided? Then he heard that still, small voice speaking peace. And I think that's the blessing of the millennial kingdom. That's the part that is still ahead of us, still future, still pending. Now, let's just observe, because that's all we're doing is observing retrospectively what has happened. Now, are we on the right track here? Well, you look for something symmetrical, something to synchronize here. From 1914 to 1945, how many years are there? Well, it's about three decades. Exactly 31 years. Well, that's interesting. At least after this 40-year gap here, it's symmetrical. Now, maybe that's not meaningful. But it gives me some glimmer of hope that maybe we're on the right track here. You know, we've got some symmetry. 1945 to 1989, well, those years would be 44 years as an interval. At least I observed that that's the same as this. We've got a symmetry here that suggests maybe we're on the right track. That's all. Just maybe we're on the right track. I think we are. Now, we're going to go from there, from here, to Acts, the 27th chapter. And some of you have heard some thoughts on this in recent years, and I'd like to review some of those and point out a few things here in Acts, the 27th chapter. Acts chapter 27 is all about Paul's voyage to Rome. I got introduced to this subject maybe 30 years ago at an LA convention when Brother Ray Luke gave a talk on this chapter, and it was fascinating to me. I just remember two or three pointers from that talk, but I remember thinking, sounds like there's something to this, that I couldn't quite put it all in focus. But then a series of studies in our class, in our weeknight study, led by Brother Keith Kleppen, helped to kind of bridge some of the points. And I think now, I think maybe Acts 27 is a little narrative that gives us more information about this period of difficulty that we're in. Now, Acts 27 is all about Paul's voyage to Rome, the center of world government. Paul is still bound by the Roman government. He's a prisoner. And may I just suggest that this period is going to be all about the harvest of the gospel age, a time during which we are still subject to the powers that be. We're still under the thumb of Rome in that respect, of the Roman Empire. But we're on our way to the center of universal authority. And I think that's what is pictured by Paul finally entering Rome and then for preaching the kingdom of God for the next period in the book of Acts ends. So after the church reaches universal authority, then the church will be in charge of the world for the next age of the Spirit, preaching the kingdom, and that's where the vision ends here. So let's suggest that in verse 20, chapter 27, verse 1, this is a picture of the harvest of the gospel age. Now it says in verse 1, when it was determined that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and other prisoners to a band, to one Julius, a centurion of Augustus's band. Now, we're going to draw on the board here a little map that's going to be Paul's journeys. Here's Turkey. Here's the land of Palestine. Comes down here with Egypt, North Africa. And Caesarea is the place where Paul starts from. Caesarea is down here on the coast, and that's where he was in prison for a considerable period of time, by the way. I think that's when Luke was at liberty to investigate all the eyewitness testimonies by which he was able to compose his gospel. I think that's the connection of the thread of history here in Paul's day. But they left Caesarea. Now, think of these names. The city of Caesarea, you obviously think of Caesar. Julius was his captor. Julius, you think of Julius Caesar, you think of the Roman. And it says he was of the band of Augustus. Augustus. You get the idea, all these three names that are telling you. Paul is still under the control of the powers that be. We, as the Paul class, as the Lord's representative on earth, the church, we're still subject to the powers that be. I think that's what it's telling us. Now, the first nine verses of this chapter, we'll just review for you briefly, and it's fairly succinct. It goes through most of Paul's voyage very, very quickly. He comes, they first go up to the city of Sidon, which is a port city here on the north coast of the Holy Land. And the passage from the two was pretty uneventful. And at Sidon, something very remarkable happened. Paul was given liberty to go and have fellowship with the brethren. Now, I consider that remarkable because Paul was a captive of the Roman government. He's nothing more than a prisoner. And yet his captor had such respect for Paul, for his character, for his Christian disposition, that he let him go at liberty. Now, how many prisoners could ask their captor, would you mind if I went ashore and had a little fellowship with my brethren? You know, I think they'd slap him and say, get back down to the galley, you know. But not with Paul. He let him go. Sidon. Sidon is that sister city of Great Tyre. Tyre, a picture of Great Christendom, Great Papacy, Sidon, the sister city. Maybe that's the Protestant world, the sister city of papacy. That's where the harvest truth really sprung up from. You know, the Reformation, 500 years ago, almost now, that's when pretty much there was a cleavage away from papacy. And now during the harvest, most of the harvest came out of the Protestant sector. Not entirely. And my sister-in-law used to be Catholic. Brother Keith Kleppen, a good elder in our class, he used to be Catholic. But most of the harvest movement came out of Protestantism. And I think Sidon represents that fact. And this was a blessed period of fellowship early in the truth movement, just like those 40 days, as it were, in which they were feeding on the Word of God and becoming strengthened during the early part of the harvest. Well, that ended. They went and took ship again, and they were going to come to a place on the underbelly of Turkey called Myra. But it says that as soon as they launched out, they found themselves in trouble. They found themselves against strong headwinds. So they had to go, it says, under Cyprus. I don't think it means this way. Other versions say, under the protection of Cyprus. And so they went this way with the headwinds, under the protection of Cyprus. And it says specifically, they passed through two seas, the Sea of Cilicia and the Sea of Pamphylia. Now, if the winds are blowing at this time, and they go through two episodes, two seas of these blowing winds that slow them down, what do the winds in Elijah's day represent? The wind, the earthquake, and the fire? It's a period of world war. How many world wars were there? Two. Two seas that they passed through full of wind. Could that represent two episodes of war? World War I and World War II. So I would suggest that when they depart here from Sidon, this departure would synchronize with the date 1914. The departure here may be 1874, and then the 40 years of harvest, and they leave there, 1914, hit two world wars. And they finally end up here at Myra, and something radical happens there. They change their ship. Now, if Brother Luke suggesting the ship represents the ship of state, and as you know the story, that ship of state is going to crash land, it's going to be destroyed sometime before they get to Rome, showing how the kingdoms of this world are coming to close before finally the universal dominion of the kingdom they arrive at. So here, the changing ships maybe represents that the old governments are gone. And that would take you to the end of the war phase, 1945, and I think that was the end of the old arrangement. Because World War I and World War II had done a double punch job of putting to rest the old kings of Europe. And now we're in a new arrangement. Now, I just to drop a little thought here for you. If you go back to Acts chapter 24, you'll see that Paul had an appearance before Felix and his wife Drusilla. Paul wasn't acquitted. And then in Acts 26, he has an appearance before Festus, who has replaced Felix. And now he has an appearance before Festus and Agrippa and his wife Berenice, three parties. May I suggest that those two rulers, Felix and Festus, represent the two different periods of time. I think Felix was before 1945, and then the government changed, and Festus represents those after 1945. Now, I don't know what your opinion is about the governments of Europe today, but whatever it is, I would just suggest to you that they're a little better than the governments before that. I think the removal of the kings that were intertwined with the papal hierarchy, that was more corrupt than what we see today. Now, we still don't see really the system we want for the kingdom, do we? That's going to come with Christ. But I think Felix was less noble than Festus, and that's exactly what it says. And Festus was the more noble of the two. Well, what about the institutions of Christendom before 1945? Well, you had the governments and you had the churches intermixed, didn't you? And that's what was going away through the world wars. But after that, what do you have after 1945? You have the churches, you have the governments, and now you have something else that you don't see until you get to plague number 6, just before Armageddon. And that's the false prophet. So you've got three entities on the scene. So maybe Festus, Agrippa, and Bernice are those three. Whereas before that, under Felix, it was just Felix and Drusilla. Now that's kind of a whole subject in itself. I'll just drop that thought there. But just make the point that by 1945, I think you have a new system of government. Now be patient with me here, some of you in particular, while I introduce just a suggestion from Daniel 11:35. Remember Daniel 11:35? It says, maybe I should read it so I don't misrepresent it. It's a very famous text, however. Did I say 11:35? I meant 2:35. Daniel 2:35. Then was the, this is when the stone strikes the image. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together and become like the chaff of the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried them away. Now, just a suggestion. When is that image finally going to be removed? And then after that, the stone begins to grow. Well, I know there's different opinions on that. I've lately come to, you might consider it a radical opinion, but I actually have the opinion now that when that stone struck, that the world wars are what struck that image. And finally, in the winds of summer, not winter. I always thought that was the winds of winter. At the end of the harvest, it would blow it away. It says the winds of summer would blow those away. What are the winds? The wind phase, World War I and World War II. Just a suggestion that that image today is no longer there. Now, I seem radical. I say, well, then what is there? Well, the stone begins to grow. What happened after 1945? Well, you had Israel that became a nation in 1948, began to expand your borders thereafter. The influence of the heavenly kingdom working through Israel is beginning to expand. Oh, it's not yet really the kingdom of God. It's not really operating among men for the blessing. Israel doesn't really have faith in the Messiah yet. But what we do see is an expansion of that center, that government, which is going to be the kingdom of God. So just a suggestion, maybe that change of ship here, maybe Festus replacing Felix, maybe that stone beginning to expand in the aftermath of the image, really all comes to consummation here. We still have, of course, the Armageddon struggle to really finish off every vestige of the old world. Now, you remember before that image was ever established, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, you had a lot of governments before that. You had Assyria, before they had Egypt. Maybe today the governments lingering are really not part of that image mixed with miry clay. Well, I warned you that might be radical. Just take that with a grain of salt, perhaps, but that's my current thinking. Well, now, we go on a little bit farther, and in the narrative, Paul enters his new ship with his captor, and they go on to the last port of call. And the last port of call on the mainland, really, it's a jut out from the mainland. It's in a peninsula, and it's called Cnidos. And you'll find that spelled strangely in King James, C-N-I-D-U-S. But there's a place to this day called Cnidos. It's there on a peninsula jutting out. And that's, they passed by there. Took them a long time to get there, it says, but they finally passed by. And now at that point, I think that would take us maybe to leaving every vestige of the old order. That's 1989, when finally, you know what, was it Bush and Gorbachev got together? Have I got the right? I think so. And the first Bush. And he said, they're going to institute, their words, not mine, a new world order. Because the old is gone. The old Soviet Empire is broken up. The old East-West conflict is really put to rest. We're in a new situation now. And I remember thinking at the time, what prevents us now from sailing right on to Rome? That is, from sailing right to the kingdom. How much farther could it be to the kingdom? And that's what they thought as well. Now there's Greece intervening here, and then over here, here's Rome. Italy, rather. There's the boot, and then Rome's over here somewhere. So they're ready to sail right on to Rome. That's what I kind of thought, anatypically. We're ready to go into the kingdom. I didn't have an idea then how many more years it might be. But it says in the picture, no, they didn't do that. They were going to, but then they got deflected. More winds came up. There were more wars that came up in difficulty, and then they had to divert for protection down here to Crete. Now here, they had to go under Cyprus for protection. Here, Crete for protection. What does that represent? Well, I'm going to suggest later on that they're going to end up here on the island of Melita, which is a picture of the nation of Israel. That's where the ship is finally going to crash That's where the trouble is really going to be unleashed, at Israel, and that's where all governments will finally fall. But we're not there yet. But do these islands also represent republics? Not the old mainland of Europe, not that old world, we left that, but republics. Could that be the United States of America? Is that where the nations went under the care of, the protection of during the world wars? Had it not been for the United States, I don't mean to trumpet you a country I happen to live in, but had it not been for the Western, across the Atlantic, governments, where would Europe be today? I read a history once talking about the Civil War in America. And it talked about, now, if the northern states had not won that debacle, if the Union was divided, would there have been enough strength, fortitude, and solidarity across the Atlantic to enter into the conflicts in the old world and really solve the problem? Not solve the problem in a big way, but in a temporary way. Or would Germany be ruling over Europe under the Nazi regime to this day? You know, what would have happened? Well, all I can say is, in the picture, they went under the protection of Cyprus here, and now I think this next blow, it's the fire, that's the Islamic terrorism, and the mainstay that's fighting that today is still that same republic, and that's the United States. And the United States, just like all the others, is a kingdom of this world. It's not, Brooklyn will not be the center of the kingdom. You know? It's going to be over in Jerusalem. So don't get the wrong idea from what I'm saying. We just want to look at how things really are happening and see if they're reflected in this as an indicator to us of what's happening. Well, it says that they barely passed this place called Salmone, which means billows. That's where the sea billows roll in. Now, during this period of time, I think we have more than just the Islamic problem. Because in Revelation, before Armageddon, you have, before that, another problem in the Western countries. Not terrorism. You have the drying up of the river Euphrates. That's Plague 6. And some brethren have been telling me for decades, before I believed them, and now I do, I caught up to them, that that would represent a withering of the economies of the Western Christianized world. You know, it was the river Euphrates that brought trade and commerce and wealth to Babylon. You dry up that river, you dry up the commerce, what's going to happen? Now, you remember back here in 1989 when communism fell and the world had only two real hopes for economic security, communism, capitalism. Communism fell. Now the whole world's looking to capitalism. That's where they're rushing into. Even China, big communistic country, capitalism is what they're trying to really forward for their economy to get it going. It seems to be working so good so far. But now the West, what's happening in the last decade? The whole thing's beginning to wither and crumble. We have the downturn in the dot-com bust in the 2000-2001. And following that, we had that banking problem in 2008. I mean, I don't even know to this day how bad that was. They tell me, you know, it could have been the death knell to it all. It's too deep for me. But it was pretty bad. And now, what, just last week, this past week, I heard the market had its worst day since the 2008 debacle. Are we in that period of billows, one coming upon another? What's coming ahead of us? I don't know. But we're in that period. So I think these billows are sweeping. They barely get by. And they come to a place called Fair Haven, right there in the underbelly of Crete. If you're writing this as a novel, you would probably choose that, Fair Haven, as a descriptive word, you know, descriptive place, to suggest that there's going to be some period of stability. And I think that we are going to get, after maybe another decade and a half, maybe to a period of stability, but not riches. Not, you know what they say about the 401k? I now have a 201k. You know, it's cut in half. People may have stability, but they won't have riches, that feeling of wealth. And so that's where the end of verse 9 comes, and that's where Paul speaks for the first time. And Paul says, I know what your plan is. Your plan is to go over to Phoenix. That old bird that rose out of the ashes? Not the city, you know, but that old bird that rose out of the ashes. And you want to regain what you had, that former glory that the Western world had. He says, don't do it. Just don't do it. Now, verse 9 says, the fast was passed at this time. Most commentaries say that means the Day of Atonement. Well, that's what, late September, early October? That's the autumn. That's when winds begin picking up in the Mediterranean. He says, it's no longer safe to sail out there. And maybe it's 12 right now, but you set out, you're going to have trouble. And they looked and they said, nah, we can do it. So they set out, and immediately they were swept up in this cyclone, this war, this wind. Euroclydon, they call it. Could that predict some problem from Europe? Well, I don't know. All I can say is today, it looks like Europe's got a problem. But whatever it is, this isn't the future yet. This isn't around the corner. I think we got another decade and a half plus on this. But they're swept up, and this storm, they're swept up and they are out of control. Now, you remember what it says in Exodus, where that plague of darkness just before the firstborn are killed? That plague of darkness, it said, lasted for 3 days. They couldn't rise up out of their homes to go about their daily business. Could that represent 3 years of really deep depression where people can't rise up to do their normal business? Things are so difficult. Well, in Acts 27, you have 3 days. Look at this in Acts 27, when the storm breaks upon them. It says, verse 17, they undergirded the ship, fearing they would fall upon the quicksand. And the next day, verse 18, they lightened the ship, throwing out part of the cargo. And the third day, verse 19, we even cast out the tackling with our own hands. 3 days of darkness. They couldn't see the sun, the moon, or the stars. But this 3 days was special intensity, but they didn't get out of that storm for 14 days. Now, you all know that this question mark represents the time of the kingdom. You all know I have an opinion about that subject. It's not the subject for today, but you know I have an opinion. If I take that opinion and I come back 14 years from that date, is that credible? I don't know. We'll see. But that would bring you to the date 2029. That's why I say it's more than a decade and a half ahead of us. Do you remember when Clinton was president? Most of you would. Do you remember his first term as president? That's about as far back as I think we have going forward before we reach that storm. That storm that will be unleashed for 14 days. Day for year? We'll see when we get there. 2029 comes, tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, Dave, remember what you said? And if I'm wrong, you have a little smile on your face. But if we're all in difficulty, then we'll have some keys to what we're looking forward to. But it says they basically lost hope. They just knew the whole thing was a loss. And Paul steps forward and he says, I've got a message for you. The last message of the church, I think. He says, an angel visited me in the night and he told me, the ship will be lost, but all the people will be saved. And that's the message we have for the world when they're ready to hear it in their desperate straits. They're looking for an answer. An angel visited us, didn't he? I think that's the seventh angel of Revelation, the messenger that the Lord used to tell us the governments are going down, the people will be saved. That's the last message of hope we give. Then the midnight hour comes. Midnight, that's the hour of the firstborn dying in Exodus 12:29. I think that's the last difficulty. I think the church passes off the scene. The great company has left. One more message representing the great company. Finally, they crash land on the island. I think that pictures Israel. That's where Paul starts to do a healing of all the people on the island, showing how Israel will be healed first. After winter has passed, then they go on onward on their journey. And they come up to Syracuse and then over to the mainland and then overland, finally to Rome. When they get to Rome, they deliver all the prisoners to a new authority. There's the beginning of the kingdom in earnest. But Israel is going to be the center of authority there. Well, let's summarize and conclude. The problem that the brethren have faced was expecting the deliverance of the church after a brief period of trouble. There will be a remarkable blessing after the trouble has passed. But the trouble is what is taking much longer than we supposed. Now we see that that trouble is in three long phases, long periods of time. We've been through the wars. We've been through the breakup of the colonial empires. We're now in the fire and the drying up of the river Euphrates phase. That will lead to the final debacle, the crash of the ship of state, the introduction of the kingdom to Israel, the passing of the winter storms, and finally the breaking of the kingdom upon a weary world that will be very ready for it. And by then we will see all this from the other side. So our hopes are not wrong. They're merely deferred. But now we can see the progress of the events leading up to the final consummation. Lord be praised for whatever we might see.
Correct.